The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. It's 4 minutes past nine on a new week, Monday the 18th of August 2025. And you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show. It's great to have you on board. I hope you had a great weekend. The weather was glorious across the Northwest, in fact, across the north of Ireland, and will continue so for the next few days. Our friends down south, some of them experiencing heavy rain and thunderstorms a little later on today, but we're clear for the next wee while anyway. And we hope you stick with us for the next 3 hours in this show throughout the day on your number one Highland Radio. We've got a great show lined up for you, of course, all the usual mix of analysis of the big news stories, the local issues, your views, and of course a focus on the people of North West with some of our features as well. The lines are open, 086 60 25,000. That's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25,000. You can also call us on 07491 25,000 and email us as well, comments@highlandradio.com. And just an early reminder for you that if it suits you, maybe you're working at home, living at home, hopefully you're living at home, but you know what I mean, working in the home or at home, you can watch us on your smart TV or your Fire Stick. We're on the YouTube app, Highland Radio Ireland, and make us a regular feature of your weekday mornings. We're there every single day across your Facebook pages, or we're across your Facebook and our pages. It's a great start to the week, isn't it? And we're also on the X platform as well. Right, so let's look at some of the stories making the front pages and inside the newspapers today. We'll start with the Derry People Donegal News. They have a focus on a Donegal woman living abroad. A Donegal woman has spoken of the terrifying moment she was forced to flee her home in Greece as devastating wildfires swept through the city of Patras last week. Emma Nidonal, originally from Gwydor, was evacuated in the early hours of Wednesday morning after waking up covered in ash and struggling to breathe due to the thick smoke filling the air. A very traumatic experience and story carried in that paper today. On to the Derry News now, and historic flags set ablaze on Derry bonfires. There's a picture of the before and after of a bonfire covered in Union Jacks and other flags. I've said it before, I don't understand, especially fully grown adults. Maybe there's a symbolism that's from both communities that's missed on me. But anyway, a big pile of pallets set alight, as we're familiar with. Two historic flags were among numerous items set ablaze on bonfires in Derry on Friday night. A crimson flag taken from the roof of St. Columb's Cathedral and a US flag over 60 years old was set on fire, along with Union flags, poppy wreaths and other emblems in the Bogside in Creggan. The crimson flag was historically flown to mock the shutting of the gates and the relief celebrations for hundreds of years, but no more. On to the Nationals now, and it could be a big day today in efforts to finish the war in Ukraine. It's a complicated one, of course, because obviously Donald Trump, since we last spoke, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin met on Friday. It was relatively constructive, it would seem. They seem to have agreed some basics. I do think Putin came out of that meeting much stronger than President Donald Trump did. But anyway, it seems the solution to this will be whether or not Ukraine will give up the Donbass region and other areas. This would have been, since 2014, an area whereby, and it wasn't widely publicized, Ukraine were bombing really quite regularly, and Russians in reverse as well. It was been rumbling and ongoing for quite some time, but it looks like that is what Putin wants. But what a cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of young lives all for a bit of land. You know, there'll be no winner as such. You know, Ukraine, if this is to end, will have to give up some of its land. Russia will get some land, but not the capital, not the rest of the country. And hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and seriously injured, many multiples seriously injured, unable to return to the front line. And for what? For what? A part of East Ukraine? It's amazing what man, in inverted commas, will do. But I mean, how many lives is that piece of land worth? You know, that sort of way. But anyway, the leaders of Ukraine and several other European states will discuss potential future security guarantees for the war-torn country with US President Donald Trump today. The meeting follows a summit held in Alaska on Friday between Mr. Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin, and claims by a White House envoy that Russia has dropped its opposition to the West providing NATO-style defence pledges to Kyiv. US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff said, "We were able to win the following concessions that the United States could offer Article 5-like protection, which is one of the real reasons why Ukraine wants to be in NATO. The Article 5 clause of NATO's founding treaty enshrines the principle collective defence, the notion that an attack on a single member is considered an attack on them all." And I suppose what they have to decide now is if that is a cost worth paying for the conclusion of that war. Back to driving test waiting times. Pressure on long-term learners to take driving tests as wait times slashed. Well, let's not get carried away. They've been reduced, right? Pressure is mounting on drivers who repeatedly apply for learner's permit renewals now that driving test wait times have been cut dramatically. Junior Transport Minister Sean Canney has signalled that once the goal of an average 10-week wait time is achieved, he'll ban the rollover of learner permits. The long-awaited crackdown on learner permit renewals comes as road safety group Park, of course founded in Donegal, released a study on national driving test waiting times, and after the Crowe report last week found major failings in Ireland's road policing system. The Park report shows that some centres have successfully managed to reduce driving waiting times from more than 18 weeks to 9 weeks in just over a year. There are about 38,000 people on learner driver licences for years and years and years on end. But anyway, I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into the figures, because apparently in Donegal, the average time for a driving test is 11 weeks, which is accurate, I suppose. But the whole story and the story for Inishowen, you have to dig a little bit deeper. And on the Inishowen Peninsula, the whole of Inishowen, it's a 12-week wait, not 11. If you're in Letterkenny, which is a huge population centre, of course, it's just 9. So still this issue remains within Inishowen, whereby it's on the hind teat on this issue. So they've a 12-week wait time. So you've 3-4 months effectively to wait in Inishowen. I don't think this is something to be celebrated. That's too long. And in Letterkenny, it's 9 weeks, which is just over 2 months. So if you look at the averages elsewhere, Sligo 9 weeks, Mayo 12 weeks, Galway 13, Clare 13, Limerick 11, Kerry 11, Cork 15 weeks. So whilst the situation is worse in Inishowen than in Letterkenny, it's not as bad as in other parts of the country as well. So there you go. There is improvements, but I don't think we're there yet in terms of lauding it too high. Sinn Féin dithers on Prez nominee, which is an interesting angle they've taken, not one they've attributed to any other party, like Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael now for that matter. But anyway, Sinn Féin have yet to decide whether to run a candidate in the upcoming presidential election or back the left's nominee, Catherine Connolly. The party is carrying out private polling to see if leader Mary Lou MacDonald has a serious chance of winning if she runs. Senior party figures didn't think she could beat Mairead McGuinness, who was Fine Gael's nominee. However, the former EU commissioner sensationally pulled out of the race for health reasons last week. A top Sinn Féin source said her exit has thrown the Aras race wide open. The party expects to make a call on their nominee by the end of this month. But if you're, I mean, we have, of course, because we've got two sitting Sinn Féin TDs here. So it'd be interesting to hear what Sinn Féin supporters think. Would you like to see Mary Lou MacDonald run for president, or would you like to see the party back Catherine Connolly, or maybe there's another option out there? Let us know. 086 60 25,000. It is interesting. I saw polling over the weekend that showed, I think, Heather Humphreys, who's most likely to be Fine Gael's, nominee. At 18%, polling 18%, Mary Lou MacDonald at 14%, which is some way behind. But that being said, 28% of people have yet to make up their mind, or don't know, or haven't thought about it, or probably won't even vote. It's a big gamble. What do you want to see from that party of your supporter? 086 60 25,000. Well, there's also obviously more coverage of what Fine Gael are going to do. It's in this paper. I can't remember where I marked it, so I might skip that over. But effectively, the story is that Sean Kelly might be throwing a spanner in Fine Gael's work. Spanner in the works for Fine Gael, because he is back in, as is Heather Humphreys, and they want him out, so it clears the way. There you go. Okay. Soaring grocery bills blamed on farmers as cost rise by 20%. Always handy to have the farmers there to blame for things, it seems. Soaring food bills are being blamed on farmers as farm gate prices rose by almost a fifth in the past 12 months, while their costs are up by less than 1%. However, the Irish Farmers Association said grocery price hikes are not down to them and are due to the EU reducing the amount of food that can be produced. Latest CSO figures show that the most significant price increases hit cattle, which are up almost 44%, with milk up 12%. But the cost of production for farmers has risen in areas such as fertiliser, which shot up 10%, and yesterday's veterinary expenses, up by almost 5%. Listen, the farmers are making more on beef because they're not allowed to produce beef, and their beef is at a premium. I mean, that's a fact. You don't have to be a farmer to see that. The price rises are across the board. You know, you can't tell me that farmers in Ireland are producing pasta, for crying out loud. But anyway, blame the farmers. That's the easiest thing. Wouldn't be surprised if the supermarkets are behind that, because it is they that are making, and this is what it boils down to, they're making record profits. They're making record profits and still increasing their prices. So, you know, blame the producer. It seems a bit lazy to me. Staying with international affairs, and maybe good people in Israel are starting to realise what's happening to their neighbours. There have been ongoing protests for quite some time, but not at a scale or in a way that was troublesome to the Israeli government. But it would seem that maybe the people of Israel are even waking up to what's happening in Palestine, because huge crowds took to the streets of Israel yesterday to launch a grassroots strike and demand the Israel government secure the release of 50 hostages still in Gaza, one of the largest coordinated demonstrations since the beginning of the war, blocked major roads and caused businesses to close. Vicky Cohen, whose son Nimrod is a hostage, said, "We are united in the simple demand directed at the Israel government. Put a proposal on the table today for a comprehensive deal to end the war in exchange for the return of the last hostages." Now, also, there were images, pictures and posters held up of starving children as well. So obviously, you know, if you've a family member of a hostage, that's maybe going to be your primary concern. But also the people of Israel, it seems some of them at these protests, at the very least, are starting to understand what's being inflicted on the population there. All right, that was a brief run through the papers today. 086 60 25,000, 086 60 25,000. Give us a call too if you want, on 07491 25,000. We're going to be chatting to our first guests on the show after a short break. I'm delighted to say good morning to Matthew Clerken, who is one of three young surfers from our draw responsible for saving three lives at Tremor Beach near Port New Friday afternoon. Matthew, Dwalta and Turlough, good morning to you guys. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
So tell us how things unfolded at the weekend.
We were just laid out in the beach, and Turla had seen kind of that the waves had picked up, so he was kind of fairly adamant that we should go down to go in for a surf. We had two boards with us, so we started just walking down, running down with the boards towards, and the closer we were getting, we weren't sure there was kind of someone crying out, like, on the shore to help, or she was saying that there was, like, kids and her kids were in the water, and her husband or whatever was in distress. So then I started paddling in Dilta, then you.
I ran up the shore on advice from Joe, Machi's uncle, who's an experienced surfer, just to get above the rip so that we could both go around the current and scoop them up then, rather than us getting caught in the current and being delayed. So by the time I got to the adult man who was in distress, Matthew, was already at the kids on his surfboard.
And yous were really quick to action. I mean, yous are obviously experienced with the water. Were yous calm? I mean, obviously you were calm enough to avoid the rip current yourselves and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of coordinating who went where, it's pretty remarkable that yous were so quick thinking and got out there so quick, Matthew.
Yeah, it was just kind of like we knew that they were in trouble. So it was like time was of the essence, I suppose. So you just started paddling as kind of as fast and as well as I could out to the kids. And Delta had got to Brian then in no time as well. We went over then and made the effort kind of.
I found it was pure instinct, really. You didn't even, you thought about it subconsciously, but it was more you just acted, you know.
Yeah.
You just knew you had to act. So.
Delta, you got the dad onto your board and took him ashore, is that right?
Well, once I got close to him, he put his hands on the side of the board. So I dragged him to the opposite side of the board to keep his head afloat out of the water. And then we kind of just collectively, Matthew and I, who were further out, collectively agreed to try and get everyone to kick their feet to paddle in. And then Turla helped us on the getting into the shore as well, because he didn't have a board. So he couldn't come out as deep.
But at that time, when everyone had extended energy, Turlock, your role was critical there as well, just to sort of get people up on dry land.
So when Matthew brought in the kids, and then once Delta kind of brought the man in closer, I helped push the board in, and then all three of us kind of helped pull the man into dry sand, where we kind of got him in recovery position, just in case he was... had swallowed too much water, or if he needed help, we just got him onto dry land.
And did you get the impression, Delta, that, you know, the energy was spent? I mean, there's a certain amount of time you can keep your head above water, literally. I wonder, or it doesn't feel like they had much time. You know, you've got there just when they need you to be there.
Yeah, it was... He wasn't in great shape when we got them energy-wise. He said it to us a few times that he didn't have much left in him, like he was very, very drained and very weak. Like even what I thought is once we got into, you know, into depth for him, that was it, that he could do the rest of the work. Well, not the rest of the work, but give a hand. But he couldn't use any leg strength at all, so we really did need three people to get him into the shore.
Amazing stuff. And Matthew, what was the kids like when you got out to them? Because you're dealing with two people rather than the one, and they're younger as well.
Yeah. Well, I got out to them, and like obviously they were in distress, and like one of them were crying or whatever. But they were very brave. Like just once I told them, like they're all right. Like they were safe now, and now we must go and get your dad or whatever. Like I wasn't kind of sure, but yeah, they were very brave, and once we got into any kind of depth that they could stand, they just went in themselves and ran up the beach, because they knew that we had to help the man out then. Like,
and Turlock, you probably got a better insight into the relief of the mother. I can't imagine what it must be like standing on the beach feeling helpless, and then you three heroes land. She must have just been beyond...
She was very distraught, yeah. I was lucky we were there. I know a lot of other people came down the beach when they saw the kind of commotion, and I think a few of her family members were also there at the beach. Mm-hmm. So they were able to come down and comfort her, and like everyone provided a helping hand. Like no one... Everyone made sure she was comfortable, whether it was giving her clothes or wrapping her up in a towel. Or I know a lot of us went up and grabbed our towels to cover the man when he got up, like, because he would have been freezing from the water. Mm-hmm. Everyone provided a hand on that beach. No one stood about doing nothing.
Yeah, but I think it's the boards that were critical here, because yous were able to get out quickly and, you know, something to grab onto or get on top of and get back into shore. It'd be very hard to have done that rescue without the boards, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
So the two children were assessed by medics and they were okay, but as a precaution, the man was airlifted to Letterkenny University Hospital. So that in of itself, the amazing rescue 118 crew landing and taking off and all, you know, the distress wasn't necessarily over once you got everyone to shore.
No, we had to keep an eye on the man. Like, he was, like, weak, like, obviously, and, yeah.
And yeah. Listen, we can all make mistakes, right, and get caught up at the moment, but I think it does serve as a good reminder, doesn't it, lads? The riptides, you know, if you don't know about them, they just pull you straight out as well. And also, and I think you kind of pointed at this, Turlock, even in fantastic weather, you know, the water, you can get cold very, very quickly.
If you don't know, like, if you struggled, if you're not a great swimmer, sometimes, like, even not as dangerous water, you can still find yourself struggle. And obviously, everyone would have been very panicked, so it would have been a lot easier to struggle. But luckily, everyone got out all right.
So Delta 3 Heroes, how's that fitting in? Is it all right? So it's a good one. You can stick that on your... You can stick that on your Tinder profile. money messing. But, you know, like, it must feel good, lads, you know, to go straight into the action. You had the guidance of Joe, and it seems to have had a happy ending as well. You must be delighted.
Yeah, it's
fulfilling.
Lucky we were there, yeah. Glad we were there to help anyway. So.
Good stuff. You're clearly three great lads as well as being heroes as well. Thanks for getting together and chatting to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, boys. And I'm only messing Delta, by the way. Hope that doesn't come back to bite you in the ass. It's only a joke. All right, good man. Take care of yourself, all three of them. Three lovely young lads. The riptides, swim across them, swim across the shore to try and get out of them. If you try and swim back to shore in the riptide, you will just exhaust yourself. And I'm not in any way attributing any blame. I don't know what happened with the family. It can happen like that. It nearly happened to us one time as well. So I understand it can happen so quick. But my understanding is you swim across them to try and break their hold and then make your way back to shore. But it just goes to show that sea is not quite as warm as you might think. If you're jumping off a pier, you're in for a couple of minutes, you swim back in, you know, it's grand. If you're wading out, have a quick swim, come back in, it's grand. But if you get stuck out there and you're panicking and everything else that happens, hyperventilating and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, listen, so proud of, and I'm sure their families are, of Maitu, Delta and Turlock and Uncle Joe as well, who is Maitu's uncle, who provided brilliant advice to them as well. They were quick on it. And they got the two kids and dad back in. The kids were assessed. They're okay. Dad was airlifted to LUH just as a precaution. And I understand and hope that he's doing well as well. And very stressful for them. But it'll take a while, an event like that, for mom and dad and the kids. It just takes a little bit a while to work through that because it's a big, big shock to the system. But these things happen. And thankfully, with the three lads there to save the day. Brilliant stuff. Okay, fair play to them. 086 60 25,000 is the WhatsApp and text number. A caller says, it's not farmers that are to blame for the rise in food prices. It's government policy and private retailers. We only have Musgraves, which is Centra, and Dunn Stores and a company down in Cork, says a listener there. Now, find it interesting to read that almost half of people admit to finding it hard to connect with people face-to-face nowadays. Now, I'm throwing this out there, but I have a fair idea what this is. It comes as the Gen Z stare. Have you heard of the Gen Z stare? It's a phenomenon going viral. It's a blank, expressionless look when asked a question or to do a task. So if you've got a young person, those three lads here, you know, that we were just speaking to, no Gen Z stares there, but you do see it. Do you ever sort of speak to a Gen Z or someone who's a bit younger and you sort of say, can you pass me that knife? And they kind of look at you and they have this dead stare, or if you ask another question, well, apparently it's happening more and more often. I'm not sure if you witnessed that, but searches for the term have quadrupled. This is the Gen Z stare in Ireland alone over the last number of weeks, sparking debate about changing social habits. So what is the Gen Z stare? Do you see it? Is it a lack of understanding? Is it a delay in process? Is it I'm not really interested in what you have to say. Are you familiar with it? Let us know. And I don't think it's a life and death thing, isn't it? I remember when I was a teenager, I had my own little ways of protesting or what was going on in my head. I'm not sure that much has changed, but maybe it has. Let me know. All right, let's take a quick break. Back very shortly here on the 9 till noon show. Great to have Northwest Truck Fest on board for the show this week, and they've got a brilliant event coming up next weekend. Get along to that if you can. It's a fantastic family experience, or couples or individuals. It's a lovely, friendly, happy, buzzy atmosphere, and it is for a fantastic cause as well. The General Secretary of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association is Brendan Byrne. He's with me now. Hi, Brendan.
Good morning, Greg.
The challenges facing the fish industry are ongoing. You know, guys and girls, but I use guys sort of cross-gender, experience every single day, you know, the struggles and the problems and the hurdles that must be overcome. And it comes in waves, doesn't it, into the sort of the spectrum of the media. And that's why it's important to discuss it when it does. How difficult is it at the moment in this area of work in this country?
At the moment, it's probably at its most difficult level in the history of the state, where we have multiple things coming at us from different angles. Over-regulation, the reduction in quota through scientific advice, the reduction in quota due to Brexit, and a combination of all that and the historical unfairness of the Common Fisheries Policy has left us in a situation, particularly in the last 5 years, where we really are struggling to exist. And that's very difficult to comprehend, because we're surrounded by the richest fishing grounds in all of Europe. We're surrounded by fishing grounds that 9 other member states from the EU are thriving from. But yet we, the owners of the waters effectively, are struggling to survive. And that is down primarily to 20 years of poor policy making and 20 years of poor engagement at European level. But particularly in the last 5 years, we have an overzealous, nonsensical approach from our regulator, which is the Sea Fisheries Protection Authority. And I think that's the straw that will break the camel's back unless some reason and sense prevails.
I mean, we know we're part of a club, we're part of a union, and we have the waters and other countries don't, and it must be divvied up. We understand that. But we don't get our fair share. In fact, we get a share that's well below our fair share, even if the waters weren't ours. So is that historic, a lack of, you know, hard bargaining, you know, taking the deal or what? How have we found ourselves in this situation?
I think initially it was naivety on the part of the government in 1983 when we went to the table when the Common Fishery Policy was set in quotas and total allowable catches. And we played the honest card saying this is what we catch, whereas the French and the Belgians and the Danes in particular, they doubled the amount of fish they were catching in the Irish waters and claimed that to be their share. And then historically, the shares that were set in 1983 are still the equivalent shares that's been caught today. So, for example, and you're 100% correct, we're only catching 15% of the fish that's caught around the island of Ireland. 85% of it is caught by other countries. That's incredible. If that was in farming, you would have 85% of your land set aside for other countries to benefit from. It wouldn't be tolerated, but yet that is exactly what is happening in the waters that surround this country. And now on top of that, based on the data that was just published last week by the Sea Fisheries Protection Authority, 38,904 tonnes of Irish quota is landed outside the state. That's depriving fish factories, fish processors of valuable fish that we could be processing, given extra work, given extra economic activity for our coastal communities. And I want to be clear here, I'm not overly criticising the vessel owners. They have taken a conscious decision to leave this country and land into Denmark or Norway or the Faroes because of the incredible, unfair and disproportionate approach of the SFPA in how we land fish. Each year, you and I have to have a debate on why Ireland can't process blue whiting because we weighed in the open air on the pier, and that destroys the quality. That's ongoing for the last 5 years and no resolution.
Well, so in relation to that, because some, I want to break it down like a pie chart almost in terms of what is the EU problem and what's the national problem. So in terms of the landing of the fishy reference there, is that not an overinterpretation or an extreme enforcement of rules from the EU? In other words, you know, we did have some missteps, let's put it like that, okay? But we're almost like over complying with the EU directives, and that means we're doing it to ourselves. And I've spoken to people locally who sometimes feel that it feels vindictive almost at times, right? I'm not saying that's the case. I'm just saying that's what some people might say. So that is in our control, isn't it? To some of this is in our control, really, is the point I'm trying to make, Brendan.
Absolutely. You're 100% correct. How we're interpreting EU directives, rules and regulations in this country, by and large, is farcical. We're absolutely no way smart. Now, if you look at what's happening in Killybegs Fishing Harbour Centre compared to Skagen in Denmark, it's the same rule book, but there's flexibility. There's an openness to do business in Skagen, whereas if you land it fishing to Killybegs, you're either prosecuted or harassed. And that is why 58% of foreign landings no longer come back to Killybegs. And that is where we are as
a
state.
And am I correct in saying too, it's not, this is with threats of criminal prosecutions?
Absolutely.
Like, which is very, very serious, just so everybody's abundantly clear in what we're talking about.
In Ireland, every transgression in fishing is a criminal prosecution. For example, there's over 200 cases before the courts in Donegal. Fishermen and boat owners being taken to court by the state because they guessed the composition of an 800-ton catch wrong. It's a guess. It's not scientifically done. It's not mathematically calculated. One of the rules and regulations of the common fishery policy is the vessel owner must guess the composition of the catch. And then the processor further does a sampling, which is further guessing and estimating the composition of the catch. In Ireland, you're brought before a jury trial because you guessed wrong. If that's in Denmark or Sweden, you get €100 on the spot fine.
There is a bit of latitude, but the latitude's incredibly tight. Isn't that correct?
I've not experienced in my 4.5 years any latitude.
Really? Well, that's really quite remarkable because, I hope listeners listening to that for the first time understand the ridiculousness of it and the fact that the playing field is incredibly uneven. But again, it's just really important because we're going to have a good old go at Europe in a moment. It's very important for us to identify what are the internal problems, because often it's easy to not deflect because the criticism of Europe can be justified, but this is stuff within our gift. And we're talking about this in the context of a visit by Tánaiste Simon Harris. He holds the international trade brief. He's also very high up in government, so it's a good ear to get. He was in Killybegs recently, climbed Mount Errigal too, I believe. And he had a bucket hat on last night as well. He's been very busy. He was at Oasis. But so when you say this directly to a person, right, because you know, you can send an email or you can, you know, hope someone hears in conversations like this, but you get an opportunity to say this directly to someone. Exactly how you've articulated that to me and how it's unfair and a lot of this is internal. What does a person say back to you in relation to that?
Well, funny, no more than the discussion you and I have had multiple times in the last 4 years, and particularly in the case with the Tánaiste last Wednesday. I think he was genuinely shocked that this is how Ireland, and he's in the second most powerful position in government in Ireland, that this is how it's been adopted and this is the approach that's been taken by an authority, an arm of state. And I think there was a genuine shock there. But we had multiple cases of how exactly the rules are being applied. And I think it set his mind in train that something drastically needs to be done. And I've been saying this for 2 years, and some people are thinking I'm crying wolf. But the reality is we are going to strangle our own fishing industry with over-regulation.
But the question then is this, how much of that is accidental and how much of that is intentional? We're starting to see now, when you start to strangle the farming industry, we're starting to see now what that actually means. That means there isn't enough beef you know, to satisfy local markets, international markets, you know, the fantastic Irish product that we produce. That would be the simplest example. When we were having conversations about beef a couple of years ago, reducing the herd or making it difficult with nitrates directives and all of that, we're starting to now count the chickens that are home to roost. You know, so it's very, we should be very clear that this is not you crying wolf. We can see it in other areas where this happens. We don't want this to be a sunset industry, but it kind of feels like that. So how much are we paying people to tie up boats? Crazy, it would seem, right? And regulating people out of the industry. We've skipped a generation. I don't know. There's a whole generation of sons and daughters of fishermen who aren't going into the industry. Who's going to pick it up if we ever get it right? The window is so blooming narrow. So how much do you think of this is intentional, and how much do you think it is us trying to be good boys in Europe?
Well, I have no doubt in my mind the over-regulation is intentional. I would even go further to say from my political life that there were a number of officials within the department that were very anti-marine, and unfortunately successive governments left them there far too long in office. Now we have a new regime. We have a very proactive minister, Timmy Dooley. We have great oversight in the Oireachtas Committee, something that Ireland hadn't got, an Oireachtas Committee on Fisheries, in 22 years. So there is a great deal more scrutiny, and the media focus, the amount of times I go through Dublin or wherever and people come up to me and talk to me about fishing. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that would not happen, because unfortunately as a sector, we stayed too long in the margins and didn't tell our story. So there is a movement growing, and no more than the campaign Highland Radio mounted in terms of Letterkenny Hospital. Campaigns on media work. They shape opinion. And that is what we're doing here, because I think the full extent of what exactly was going on from government policy and from the regulatory bodies has not yet been told. Bad and all is what I just said to you. There's worse to come in how this industry has been mislabeled by successive
government. I don't want to be cynical, but I mean, like, if you are from the Midlands or the East Coast and you're in a position of power, or you're, you know, a suit in the civil service or whatever, I mean, you're not going to care about people fishing off the West Coast. You know, how could you? How could you understand the cultural significance of it? How could you understand the history, the generations, the importance of it? You just go, sure, put in a solar panel farm or a wind turbine or something. What do you do with that old fishing cracker? We can get that elsewhere. I do worry sometimes when we have sort of an East Coast based civil service, senior civil servants, by the way, I want to make that distinguish, and also people in power, you know, like there was quite some time where our fisheries minister were from counties that didn't even have a coastline.
That's correct. And then we had fishery ministers that had a coastline, and they were equally as bad because they didn't bother themselves.
Be careful.
Consulting with us and wouldn't hardly even meet with us. And some ministers even went further and tried to get individuals such as myself sacked because I was too vocal.
Really?
But back,
was that recently?
Back to where we are. This is a national question. There's 17,000 jobs at play. These are many intels that are right around our coastal communities. They're not replaceable. If you lose Killybegs as a primary fishing centre, or Greencastle, or Castletown Bear, there isn't an instant quick fix. These are coastal communities that go back to the time of King James the First, when the first charter for fishing was issued. We need to wise up to this.
You can't put the genie back in the bottle.
There's 17,000 jobs at stake here.
Yeah, for sure. You can't put the genie back in the bottle of this. When that infrastructure is gone, it's gone. In terms of the common fisheries the policy, what is the story there? I mean, you know, there were talk as that sometimes when big decisions about to be made that we're engaging in Zoom calls rather than being over in Europe banging on the table, right? I mean, why can't we get a fair crack? Why can't we speak out? Why can't we on a European level identify the fact that we're 15% of our waters we can fish in? That we could, there's people, the countries, not even in Europe, seem to have better access to our own waters.
There's a few reasons, not least of which our presence at European Commission level from officials is very poor. And for the last 20 years, it's been extremely poor. And one of the key things and key outtakes from Minister Simon Harris' visit to Killybegs last Wednesday was that he accepted that And in the interview with Highland Radio, he said that's something that needs to be done. And I'll give you a compare and contrast. Ireland has one fishery representative in Europe full time. The Dutch, I think, have about 14 or 15.
No, okay. That's
And the Danes have 6 or 7. And here we are. The level of incompetence that has managed this sector for the last 20 years is staggering. It's mind-blowing. And the full story will have to be told. But meanwhile, there is a fight back for the industry because even with all of what I've outlined, the people that I represent in the processing sector over the last 4 years have invested 105 million euros of their own money into their factories because they can see a future. There is a future there, but we need a government and a civil service, public service at national and European level that buys into that rather than seeing us as a hindrance, which has been their approach for the last 20 years.
Yeah, if I was over in Europe and I can see one country with 14 reps and one with one, I'm thinking the one with one ain't that bothered about the industry. That would just be a perception. That would be the starting point for any negotiation or what have you. They're not interested, sure. Okay, interesting stuff as always, Brendan. And you make it very clear for us to understand, which is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's the General Secretary of the Irish Fish Processors and Exporters Association. Some quite interesting commentary within that piece as well, if you read between the lines. Deputy Michael Collins is leader of Independent Ireland. He joins us now. Good morning, Michael. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Greg.
You've set your two barrels on private health insurance, the private health insurance industry. It does seem to be a industry unto itself, really.
It certainly does, and I raised a number of questions because over the weekend, one of the companies announced a 4.5% increase in private health insurance, which again hits the ordinary middle-income families, and hits them hard in a time that's difficult, with cost of living crisis that's out there. And I've called and I've written to the Health Insurance Authority to call into question all about the structures of health insurance in Ireland. I've also written to the Minister for Health to step in here, not to allow this increase until the HIA, the Health Insurance Authority, come back and explain to the people of Ireland why is, first of all, health insurance gone sky high, through the roof. A number of years ago, if you had health insurance, you had 3 or 4 plans and you paid for that. Now you have about 20 plans costing, and each plan is costing money. So they're individualising each and every plan that they're rolling out there. Also, we had a situation where people, if you had private health insurance, if you were paying huge fees, and understandably, you'd get seen to straight away. Now, some people are waiting for a consultation for up to 12 months. I had a case last weekend, but it's somebody that it's almost certain they have a cancer issue to deal with, and it was a crisis situation, and they were told by their private health insurance after contacting the hospital that they won't get seen after for at least a consultation to about 6 months, and they can't wait for 6 months. It's a frightening experience for them. And also, another case recently, and quite a lot of different cases coming into me, the health insurance company are saying they're covering their patients with comprehensive cancer cover. I had a patient with stage 4 cancer that when he went, and he was paying a huge amount of money every year, and he was quite happy to do that because he thought he had comprehensive cancer cover. But when he went and when he had stage 4 cancer, when he was told the treatment he was to be treated with, and he went back to his insurance company, he said, you have comprehensive cover, but we don't cover that type of cover. So, there is a lot of issues here.
I think you managed to get them to honour that policy in the end, didn't you? You raised it in the Dáil, so you sorted it out for that man.
I did, but that's unfortunately how many people haven't been sorted out or didn't go taking up the same route as this family travelled. Yeah. And I literally had to drag the company through the gutter to do that, and that's not the right way. Because if you're driving a car, Greg, and your car is comprehensively covered, you assume that if you have an accident, you're fully covered. But in this situation, you're not.
And just briefly, it's often we think about it's new entrance to the market. Like myself, I don't have health insurance. So say, for instance, I went to look for it and it's too expensive and I can't get it. But I really think more about those that have it. And it's the one bill they have to pay because there could be someone in the house with an illness or an ongoing issue. And it's a bill that they have to meet and they have to absorb every increase. And it's a terrible pressure put on families, probably dealing with someone who's sick in the household, but also probably, you know, not having the money to meet these costs. Like, that's not really right, is it?
It's not fair, you know, and this is where it's time now for the minister to intervene here, because it looks like the regulatory body are not going to intervene here. They're quite happy and quite accepting that the insurance goes up. But the biggest issue here is that, as I said, only a few years ago, they had 3 or 4 plans, but they have now, cleverly enough, the companies have broken into 20 plans and they're putting a costing onto every plan. So they're legitimately selling it out there as they think is legitimate, but in fairness to the general public out there, they're not getting a proper service anymore. Number one, they're paying huge fees. Some people, you know, are trying to start off and it was health insurance, and, you know, it's commendable that they are. But I think that the government needs to put a bit more confidence in the market, and I think they should hold off on any increase until this confidence is returned to the market, to the private health insurance, and it's not there at this present time anyway.
All right, Michael, listen, thanks very much for your time. I do appreciate it. Deputy Michael Collins there, leader of Independent Ireland. We'll be back after the news and obituary notices.